Welcome to the Best Science Medicine Podcast, BS without the BS. Hi, everyone, and welcome to the 470th episode of the Best Science Medicine Podcast. My name is James McCormack, and I'm a professor with the Faculty of Pharmaceutical Sciences at the University of British Columbia.
I'm Mike Allen. I'm a family doctor and the director of practice support at the College of Family Physicians of Canada. I'm also an adjunct professor at the University of Alberta.
And we're now to the trilogy of this podcast series. Yes.
We are, and hopefully it's not going to turn into the never ending story.
And the problem is none of it's true. So, but we'll go from there.
So we did a couple podcasts, as many of you likely know, on the kind of thinking errors that we can make in general, but also specific to medicine. And we talked about the first piece. We spent a little bit of time on some conspiracy theory stuff, just out of interest and in how it relates to this, but then got on to the idea of storytelling and how stories are very powerful. And we tell them in medicine all the time. And sometimes when we can allow them to distract us from what we think might be the best available, or what we think might be the best available evidence. And we gave examples like the antioxidant story. We gave examples of Encanide and Flecainide for post-MI extra beads.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And we also talked a little bit about how stories change. So we talked about the kind of nature of beta blockers in heart failure and how that changed. And we came up with the idea that maybe stories are a little bit like silly putty, because you can kind of change them. You can pick up stories that you need to adapt to things when they change. But the examples we gave are just kind of scratching the surface. And James and I talked about lots of others.
There's dozens of them. Like, and as I've probably said 1,000 times on this podcast, don't get me started about diabetes.
Yeah, like sugars and cholesterol. And we've made people fearful of cholesterol. And we do a lot of these things. And so we really did, though, I think, James, beat to death the idea of stories in medicine.
Yeah, and but it's important to realize, I mean, it depends on the definition of story. Because, you know, most conversations are sort of a story in nature. It's the story of, and I think more so the story of the stories that are associated with fear and mechanism of action. I mean, those are the two biggies in medicine that create problems, with sort of going down a garden path that has been shown too many times to not be true.
Yeah, like vitamin D to prevent MS when we don't know if that's the case. Omega-3s based on some population data. These kind of jumps and leaps of assumption based on a little bit of information and a supposed understanding of physiology. Yeah. But let's go on to the next couple. And I think people will also be quite familiar with these, but there's also some science behind them. So the first that we're going to talk about you may remember this line, James, from a certain song of your generation. Mm-hmm. A man hears what he wants to hear and disregards the rest.
Yeah, and what's so nice is it never happens to women.
Yeah, well, that's the time where we wrote about man meaning everyone, in many ways not meaning everyone. Yeah. So we would correct it to mean what a person hears.
Yes, exactly.
What they want to hear, and they disregard the rest. And I think that statement, although a brilliant line from a Simon and Garfunkel song, is actually well known in cognition literature, thinking literature, about one of our major flaws as people. And to give an example of that happened in the present day, you just need to look at what was happening around the time of the U.S. election. So when new information comes, do we change our mind? Or do we look for reassurance in old ideas? So one of the things that I looked at, I found interesting, was the story that, and this happened in a lot of places in the news media, but I heard rumor that for CNN, when President Trump was first elected, they weren't negative enough on him and they were losing listener and viewership. So they kind of switched and kept their numbers. On the other hand, after the most recent election, Fox News ended up reporting more of the actual real election results, and their numbers went down as a result. And one of the further right news coverage was called Newsmax. And there's some really interesting data that they went from having around 50,000, maybe a few more people watching per week, this one time slot, that jumped up to around 200. And the very next week jumped up to over 300,000 because they were covering the election the way people wanted to hear it.
Well, at least to some people. And that's the, you know, so it's just like how you create, you know, you create friendships and all that sort of stuff. You tend to go towards people that are a little bit more like you, you know, right. And sometimes to the detriment of you learning anything new.
Yes, and, absolutely.
You know, and, but, you know, so you're right. If CNN or Fox I would imagine there's a fair amount of, purposeful, change in what they do to attract viewers, but you know, if you go down a path that people are no longer or a group of people aren't interested, they're going to seek out something else.
They're going to seek what they want to find. Yeah. That's what this is very interesting to me. And I made a pie chart for James of debates on social media, how they end up. And the one option is that you could learn and grow from your debate. The other people could learn and grow, or everyone's frustrated and angry, and you can guess which of the pie chart it fills.
Right.
Everyone being frustrated and angry with debates on social media. But, you know, when I looked at this kind of thing, and I'm sure we can, there's lots of quotes like the one from Simon and Garfunkel, and there's lots of data from things like the Newsmax that I gave you. Mm-hmm. But what I found interesting was there's actual science on this kind of thing. So, This is a study that was published in 1975, but I think speaks a ton to the way we think as individuals. So what they did is they took first high school students and then they repeated it in undergrad students. And what they did is they were given 25 cards with writing on them. So kind of like your old study cards or cue cards. And you would read those study cue cards. And on them was an indication that was a suicide note story. And the person would read them and try and guess whether it was a real or fake suicide note. They were hooked up to electrodes because they told them they were monitoring their brain, but that wasn't really what they were doing. And their physiology response. That's what they were told. It was a study around that. Mm-hmm. But what they did is they gave them these cards and then they had the students guess whether it was a real or a fake note. What the students didn't know was they were already pre-assigned to do well, do average, or do poorly. And they, so if I was delivering this test to James, I would give him a question and, or I would have him read card one and he would read it and then guess whether it was real or fake. And I would say to him, oh, that's great. You got that right. And then I would say it 24 times, in other words, 24 out of 25 times to reassure him that he was getting it right. If it was the average response, I gave him 17 out of 25 right. And if it was low, I gave him 10 out of 25 right.
And you have you have to love deception trials because they're so clever sometimes and to answer some questions that we really want to try to answer. And, you know, that's the beauty about sort of deception trials. And there's a whole bunch of ethical issues around it, but it's kind of fun to do.
It's fascinating to look in on them. And so then what they did is they went away and came back and said, actually, the whole thing was a ruse. We weren't really telling you whether you were good or bad at these. That we already decided you know, there's no association between how you actually guessed and how you actually do. But they then said to them, would you mind indicating whether you think you'd be good at this for the future? And if they were someone who was told they were good, then they consistently estimated that they would be good later on, even though they were now informed
that they hadn't been good. They were just, whatever.
That it had been a fake right along. So 65, if you were in the if you were in the group that you thought you were really good, 65% of those felt that they were above average. And only 15% thought that they would be failures if they were in the above average group. Mm-hmm. And then that pretty much exactly reversed for the failure group.
Right. Yeah.
So once you've got a belief, even if you're told that belief is wrong, it doesn't matter because the belief has been seeded and planted.
Yeah. And again, it's important to look at the numbers because it's not everybody.
Yeah. You know, it's, no, not everyone.
But you're looking at, you know, probably about a 50% switch here.
Yeah. Yeah.
Roughly
and then
speaking.
Repeated it. Here's what's fascinating, too, is they repeated it in the graduate students, found the same thing.
No, you mean in undergrads?
Sorry, undergrad students. Yeah. And they got the same thing, although they didn't use an average rating. They just used high and low this time. Mm-hmm. And what they did as well was they had someone observe the person doing the experiment with the same level of deception. What was interesting is not only is so, and then they were both told, though actually later on they were told, no, that was actually a deception. It was only, and they found that time didn't matter. If you did it even 5 minutes afterwards, you still had you could not be changed in your thinking. You still had a strong belief. If you were told you were good at something, you believed you were good afterwards. If you were told you were bad, you believed you were bad at it afterwards, even if you were corrected within 5 minutes. So the other piece they did here is had this observer watch. And what they found was that observers in the groups also would rate. So if someone was targeted as a success and they did it repeatedly 24 out of 25 times, mm-hmm. the observer would also say that they thought that person was going to do well in the future at guessing.
And so I guess sort of the conclusion, I guess words matter. It's almost, yeah. You know, of whether you tell someone there that they did really well or really badly, that tends to stick with them. And, I guess what you should do is just tell everyone they're average.
Well, we're going to get to that.
Yeah, for sure.
Another thing, but
it really said, but I was going to say, it really says, but once you've sort of formed those impressions, it's really hard to take you back. Now, these are relatively artificial environments, obviously, because this doesn't happen really in the real world. But it's just a way of showing that there is an influence that once you create an impression, it sticks somewhat.
Yeah, I think it's, you know, because we certainly, you know, you can find these things like we see and who listens to certain types of news. We've already mentioned it was mentioned by Simon and Garfunkel and many, many scholars and important people mm-hmm. in the past. But knowing that there is actual science about how strong that is, it's fascinating. And I'll give you one more. This was published in 1979 by a similar group. And what they did here was, so as you know, once I kind of form my ideas, they become difficult to erase. But what about if an idea is already formed? How much influence can we make? So what they did is they took undergrad students here, almost 50 of them, and they broke them up into half and half. What they did is they had them fill out a survey around capital punishment. And they took those who felt very strongly pro and those very strongly con or against. And they took half and half of each. And then what they did is they asked them to participate in this study. And again, it was a deception. What they did is they gave them information that was false. But they each got a 3-sentence description of a factitious study supporting or refuting capital punishment as a deterrent for further murder. And then they gradually added more and more content to the information that they were getting. So they got more details about the study. They got critiques of the study. They got what the authors would have responded. Now, to them, it was real, but it was all fake. The authors just made it up. And they kept it so that the stories were, if you got a story about kind of statewide data and that's what they were using, then they flipped that statewide data so it would one group would see it as for and one group would see it as against. And that way they managed to balance, each study got, each group got basically the same studies.
Right.
And this will come as absolutely no surprise, but if a study agrees with what you already believe, you think it's good. You rate the quality of the study better, and it strengthens your resolve in whatever direction your resolve is already headed.
Yeah. And you see that all, I mean, I see this all the time, and it drives me sort of crazy when you listen to the arguments on one side or whatever. And here, you see this all the time, Mike. You see how, you know, when a, you know, a definitive study is being done, here's what I'd like to say. I would like to say, before we tell you the results, go back and look at the study and tell me, do you think it's any good?
Yeah.
Because it is so common when you hear arguments on one side or the other, especially if you're, they're very, you know, pro one thing or another, you know, you'll show them a study, and then if it didn't agree with them, they'll come up with all the flaws. And
right. And so and that's exactly what these guys did. So if it was against their belief system, the study was inherently flawed. Even though, as I mentioned to you, they're basically the same, like a different group got a different study, but it was the same study. So it was fascinating how we just reversed what, and we see this. And a friend of mine, Jennifer Young, will say to me, if a study makes you feel something, you probably brought in baggage with you when you read it.
Yeah.
And she's exactly right. So what the author, and we can give you, there's subtle changes in an 8-point scale of how it moved. It doesn't really matter. What matters is you barely move at all. Like, let's say I was a proponent of capital punishment and they gave me evidence that was very much against capital punishment. It would move me a tiny bit, maybe, towards being less, or you know, maybe being a little bit more against capital punishment.
Right.
But the amount of shift for the same study the other way, if it was for me, was much stronger. And I would also devalue the study even while it was slightly shifting my thinking. But it didn't shift it much. Yeah. So there's a great line from, I think this guy's name is Calbraith. Faced with changing our minds or proving we don't need to, almost everyone gets busy proving.
Yeah. Yeah. No, and it's tough. I mean, you know, you and I sort of look at this stuff for a living, and I find it, you know, whenever a new study comes out, and, you know, if I read the abstract and I look at it and I go, and it supports my prior beliefs, I have to almost, in my head, I got to go, be careful. Go look at what the trial was. It well done? Was it? And if you, and again, we are not immune to this at all, Mike.
Oh, no, I was thinking of the most recent study this year that looked at, or maybe it was just last year, that looked at lipid levels for post-stroke patients. And sure, there are flaws with it, but there are flaws in the studies that don't support the lipid hypothesis. And so, yeah, I thought we said, yeah, that is that what that showed was you can use the approach of targeting lipids. It's just more complicated.
Yes, exactly. But they got
the same result. It's not that one is more effective or less effective, just one is easier.
Yeah. I think that's one of the strengths of people who, if come up with a process of how you evaluate a study first and then consistently use that process, unless new information comes to light to say this is a better way to do it. But use that as your key thing, because I know groups that, you know, they've never met a study they liked, and vice versa, right? You know, every study is good.
Like everything.
These things are very, these are tricky to do. And so that's, you know, one of the reasons that we try to let people, when we talk about these things, is you almost have to get to the point where you get people who you trust to develop the information. And that is not easy. You have to, you can't just go, you know, I guess by here, you know, people say, why don't you trust these guys or whatever, but you sort of have to listen to what they're saying. And as much as I, as much as possible, I try to show people I don't care at all. And, you know,
well, that used to be our joke, right? Yeah. We don't care.
Yeah.
That was going to be, I said that that should be the motto of the peer group. We don't care.
We don't care. Yeah.
And obviously that has negative messaging, but it's.
Especially in medicine.
Especially in medicine. But it is an important thing you want from people who interpret evidence. You don't want them to really care what the results say.
Yeah.
You want them to be dispassionate about that.
Yeah. But just as an example, as we're doing, as you know, you talked about CNN and Fox and all that sort of stuff, and we're sort of making an assumption that one is the mirror image of the other, which they're not. You know, they're not. You know, they are two of the bigger ones. And so I purposely listen to both, and they mm-hmm. both drive me crazy.
Yeah.
You know,
go ahead.
No. And so, you know, that's, you know, one of the ways I when I try and look at things, and I'm blessed with having a job that allows me the sort of time to do this, is I actually seek out people who have completely opposite opinions to what I would believe, or opposite opinions to what I think the evidence shows. And I want to hear their arguments, because you sometimes get nuggets from them that are good. A lot of it isn't, but you sometimes get some nuggets. And so it's really valuable to listen to what other people say in regards to this, and then try and see, you know, why are they saying it? And you know, if you talk to people who are, you know, believe in conspiracies, it doesn't matter what you say.
Yeah. Once it's established far enough. And so that gets us to this next point, which is from Max Planck. And it is, I'm going to read you the quote exactly. A new scientific truth does not triumph by convincing its opponents to see the light. Rather, its opponents eventually die, and the new generation grows up with the new scientific truth. And this has been summarized down to, science progresses one funeral at a time.
It's a great line. It's sadly somewhat true.
It is somewhat true, but not, certainly there has been some research that shows that people can adapt to new information. It's just difficult. And we'll talk about that in a minute as an example in diabetes again. Now, these things have all sorts of different names and subtle different ways in which they're defined, things like confirmation bias, academic bias, predisposition bias. I called it predisposition bias the most, because I think that explains it the best. But it's basically a person hears what they want to hear, then disregards and refutes the rest.
And I would suggest to you, Mike, and I don't have any solid evidence on this, but I'll say it anyway. I believe those biases are as, if not more important than financial conflicts of interest.
Well, I think they're. I don't think we'll know. That's the problem.
No, I don't think you can know, because they're definitely somewhat linked, but they're both really important. And you know when we're, you know, you and I do lots of talks, and we have to give our conflicts of interest, and 99.9% of the time we are only asked to talk about our
financial
conflicts of interest, and that. Misses so much good stuff, but then it's really hard. What would you put down? You know, I mean,
be there forever, right? If you started to write down all the articles you've ever written, because that may influence how you think, et cetera. Mm-hmm. So just as an example of how we think about conditions and once we've kind of got a belief, one of the beliefs that we have is that, dialysis is all of our diabetic patients, or many of them, will end up on dialysis. Mm-hmm. That's kind of the teaching we sometimes get.
We could be talking about type 1, but primarily we're talking about type 2.
We're talking about type 2 here. Yeah. And, you know, you and I presented this study years ago. Yeah, in the U.S. And we had someone who was furious with us because she felt that we were clearly wrong. Mm-hmm. But we asked the question, if you had 1,000 patients with diabetes and you followed them for...
They've had diabetes for 10 years.
They've had diabetes for 10 years.
Yeah.
And they were more progressed because 50% of them also had either micro or macro albuminuria. So that... that's similar to some other studies where they've tried to pick those most at risk for negative outcomes related to diabetes. And then if you follow them for 7 more years, how many would need dialysis out of that 1,000 versus how many would have died?
Yeah. So I want listeners to think, so how many, if you have a type 2 diabetic in front of you who's had diabetes for 10 years, and they're, half of them have some evidence of, you know, laboratory kidney issues going on, and you follow them for 7 years, out of 1,000, how many people will go on dialysis? And I won't put a drum roll in, but play one in your head.
So it's 7. If you're thinking it's either 6 or 7 out of the 1,000.
You're good, yeah. Now, not out of 100, out of 1,000.
Nope. Yeah. Yeah, it's a little less than 1%.
Yeah.
But how many will actually die from heart attack and or how many will die, first of all? Yeah. That's something like 30 to 40% of them will die. And half of those will be because of cardiovascular disease.
Yeah. No, and I've seen, you know, I've seen this anyway, because when I ask people, I remember asking some people who work in dialysis units. And I've asked them this exact question. And some of them say 20 to 30% go to dialysis.
Yeah. And that's, if you recall, the person in question before, she was so furious because she thought it was upwards of 30 to 40% that were,
And
it's
it's an interesting sort of discussion. This is where the nuance is so tricky, because people who see people on dialysis, the most common cause of dialysis is type 2 diabetes, but almost nobody with type 2 diabetes gets dialysis.
Yeah, because it's a numbers game.
Yeah, right? It's all a numbers game. And it gets getting even worse because we're diagnosing more people with diabetes.
Right.
Because as soon as you lower the threshold and all that sort of stuff. And so people have a difficult time with the fact that you can have it be the most common cause of and have almost no one get it.
And this is, there's lots of examples like that in medicine, James. As you know, the most common people to get MIs are those who are grouped in the low risk category, or they get them more than the moderate risk category. Yeah. And that's because there's so many more of them. If you look at Down syndrome, children are born more frequently to women under the age of 35, but not because the absolute amount is bigger, but the relative amount is much smaller.
Yeah.
Because it's because so many more women under age 35 are giving birth that it's more likely in them just because of the sheer volume.
Exactly.
Where we know the risk is actually higher over age 35.
This is a great example of what we think healthcare providers need to know. Do you have a ballpark number? I can't tell you how little I care. If someone said, I didn't know it was 7 in 1,000. I thought it was 15. You're still really close.
Yeah, you just have to know it's really low.
You need to know whether is it 1%? And that's what we do with all of these risk estimates. So I always say, you know, you need to know, is it around 1 or 2%? What about, you know, maybe somewhere between 5 and 10, 10 to 20, and then greater than 20. And if you know those ballpark categorizations, you're way ahead of the game.
And if you have a general understanding that death is about 50 times more likely than dialysis.
Oh, yeah.
And that alone for a long-term diabetic. But let's talk about changing our minds, because that's kind of what this is. And this comes from a wonderful editorial entitled from the ACP Journal Club called "What Does It Take to Put an Ugly Fact Through the Heart of a Beautiful Hypothesis?" And that's the same thing as what we've been talking about. What changes our mind? So take the ACCORD Advance and Veteran Studies. They came out and were published in 2009 or so, or sorry, 2008 or so.
Yeah.
And some of them were published ahead of time as leading up. In fact, the Veterans was published in 2008, and the others a little ahead, with publication before print. And what they found is if you looked at the outcomes, it wasn't very positive for most outcomes. And in ACCORD, actually, they had worse.
And just so people know, these trials are trials that look at getting people tighter glucose control.
Right. And the ACCORD trial, which was the biggest to that date, demonstrated worse cardiovascular mortality with aggressive management. And so published that year, interestingly, within a year, was an update of the Canadian Diabetes Association clinical practice guidelines. And the veterans was maybe too close for them to catch and include, but certainly it was enough time for them to include ACCORD and ADVANCE. And really, ACCORD and ADVANCE were the only big studies that look specifically at this question. UKPDS did look at some of the questions, but that was more, does this intervention work in early diabetes? And it wasn't really a target trial.
No, not at all.
The ACCORD and ADVANCE were target trials. And the Canadian Diabetes Association did actually record what happened in those trials and how there was very little effect. But they went on to say in their recommendation that patients should be treated to achieve an A1C target of less than 7. Even though ACCORD and ADVANCE, the two best trials by far, showed no difference or worse outcomes.
How
do we get there?
And the tricky part, why don't you say how you got there, and I'll add my 2 cents worth.
Well, they summarized the ADVANCE trial did not show this increased mortality that the ACCORD trial did. It did, however, show a reduction in nephropathy in the intensive control group. Now, James, what do you think nephropathy really was?
I know it wasn't dialysis.
No, it was microalbuminuria.
Yeah.
It was crossing a threshold for microalbuminuria, which I haven't had a patient complain about that in my life. But they did go ahead and say that patients should be treated to achieve these aggressive targets when all the evidence they had for real outcomes was worse for these patients.
Yeah. And just so you know, so even that reduction in nephropathy was about 2%. Maybe 2 to 3% of a surrogate outcome. So it wasn't like, it was a 10 or 15% absolute difference. It was 2 to 3% over, sort of the 5 or so years. And that's a problem with how you take select pieces of information and sort of massage it around, when in fact they could have easily just gotten away with it to say something like this. I have no problem. They can still go ahead and recommend less than 7, but just say, unfortunately, we don't have any trials to support it, and the two that are say this, and leave it there.
But we really think that sugars are bad.
Yeah, yeah.
And that is so important to us that we recommend this. Be forthright about it.
Yeah, I've talked to it. They just will never do this.
Yeah, yeah. And there's a systematic review of diabetes guidelines published in 2018 that found that there was the A1C target varied considerably between guidelines. And really, the lower the target, the weaker the use of evidence became.
Yeah.
So it's just interesting that this whole idea of once we get a fixed belief, we stick to it. It's been shown in psychology. We've known it all along from a kind of philosophical point of view, but it bears recognizing how it rears its ugly head. And now that we have had no further trials demonstrating that low A1Cs have worse outcomes, you can see that we're starting to drift back there, and it's allowing us to argue for lower A1Cs. We really only loosen the restrictions for those older patients, those comorbid patients. And you can almost feel a discomfort in relaxing these targets. Yeah.
And what they'll often not mention is that in almost all of these trials, when you try to do more aggressive treatment, you get a higher chance of hypoglycemia.
Yeah, yeah. And you get all sorts of things. Like, there's a study that showed, this wasn't in a trial, it was an observational study, but it showed the more aggressive sugar control for people getting assistance in the home, so older patients, frailer patients, those getting assistance, the lower your sugar was, the higher the likelihood you had of ending up back in or ending up in long-term care.
Yeah, and here's we also have to take this into, I think you have to take this into account, because in this example, let's assume that these trials showed what they showed. I mean, we're still talking about a 1% increase in mortality in one trial, and then the nephropathy was reduced by about 2 to 3%. It still tells you, even you can choose whichever piece of it, it's still not much of a difference, no matter what you do. No. But here's what it is to get to lower sugar levels, it's 100% guarantee you have to use more medications, and it's more inconvenient. Because it's more difficult, right? So you've definitely got parts of that package of harm if you do it, where the benefit is at best minimal and maybe even harmful.
So you might think we're picking on diabetes. Oxman and Guyot from 1993 did a review looking at how authors write reviews and review evidence. And what they found is that experts on average write reviews of inferior quality. And the reason they felt that way was the greater the expertise, the more likely the quality was to be poor. And they felt that it was most likely related to the strength of prior opinions. This was from 1993. So we knew then that the more refined expertise in a very specific area that someone has, the harder it is for them to look at evidence objectively.
Yeah, because they have been involved with a story for so long.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
It's going to be very, very hard for them to shift their thinking when new evidence comes along. And I'm not saying, as you've indicated, James, that everyone's like this, but speak to why we've been accused in science of progressing one funeral at a time.
Yeah. And because there's absolutely no doubt, I could fill relatively small rooms with the number of cardiologists and endocrinologists who sort of agree with some of the things we're saying, but I could fill huge rooms on the opposite side. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, this all drifts down to the people at the sort of coal face of interface of treating patients, whether it be GPs or pharmacists or nurses or and the diabetic educators and all that sort of stuff. They're taught to follow guidelines. And the beautiful thing that I've always said about guidelines is go ahead and treat whatever way you want. I can pretty much guarantee I can find a guideline to support you. I've seen it with what you give for the treatment of pneumonia, what you give to blood pressure, or any of these things. You can. And I'm obviously, most people don't say I couldn't find a guideline that would say what you do for pneumonia is treat it with hydrochlorothiazide. But that sort of concept, you can find many guidelines to support what you're saying. And the most recent Canadian diabetes guide, actually, maybe I don't know if one's come out since that time, but the most recent one, that diabetes guideline was, 320 pages.
And it's still short, right? Is what you're trying to say.
Yeah. It's short on evidence. Yeah. Cause it's actually fun. I had a number of students, say, so I gave them all sorts of different guidelines one time, and I asked them can you go through them and get information that you need to help you make decisions? And usually, the longer they were, the less information they could get out of them. Because
that's so true.
They just couldn't, because they just ramble on and on and on and on. But anyway, it's really interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So let's talk about the one other way that we kind of... Yeah. Have mistakes in our thinking, and this is a fascinating one for me as a teacher, but it's not just in students, it's in all of us. So I want to ask you first, and everyone out there, I want you to think, how good a driver are you? I mean driving a car or truck, if you like, whatever. How good a driver are you? Are you A, terrible? Are you B, below average? C, average? D, above average? Or E, amazing? And I want you to reflect on how good of a driver you think you are. We could substitute this with anything, how good of a conversationalist you are, really anything.
How good a lover are you?
You had to go there, of course.
Well, of course.
But this is from two people, Dunning and Kruger. And I think their first study is the one that you probably... would appreciate you could take a look at. It's from a journal called Personality and Social Psychology from 1999. And this is another one of these psychology studies, but it showed that in that competency and kind of insight are completely dislinked or virtually dislinked. So what they did is they did four studies, and psychology studies, for those of you who haven't read them, are often like this. They're multiple. When they publish, it has multiple small studies building on a theme over time. So the first one was humor. So they asked people about humor. And do you think you're good at it, and those kind of things. Then they asked them logic. And they did grammar and reflection on grammar, and then again back with logic. But this time they did some training with them. And what they found was when they asked people, where do you think you are on the scale kind of how good, scoring from 0 to 100, almost everyone puts themselves above average. So that's why I asked you to reflect on how good a driver you are.
Most people, in case you guys are trying to do the math, that's impossible.
But so the bottom quartile averages themselves to around 65%, and the top quartile, those who are actually very good, let's say at driving or humor or logic or whatever, they're kind of around 65% self-rating. Mm-hmm. So we have almost no idea how good we are at something. So when they actually quartile them out, that is still, so the bottom quartile, those who are absolutely terrible at humor, position themselves at six, that they are
two-thirds
around. Yeah, they're about two-thirds. They're above average in their ability of humor or logic or driving or whatever. And this has been consistently shown. It was shown across all four of these. There's this great little graph of this line that goes up in ability. And then this line that's straight across in our self-rating that shows that we doesn't matter how good you are. Only after the people who are at the top were told that you are really good did they start to rate themselves higher. And only then, the other thing that they did is they gave them, so in the writing example, they gave them a reflection on grammar. And the people who were at the top, once they saw other people's writing, they started to rate themselves. They didn't put themselves at 95% or something, but they bumped themselves up a little bit. But those who were at the bottom and had rated themselves as above average didn't change much when they were shown their writing compared to other people's. Not marked. They just could look at theirs and look at other people's. Now, this is the crux. The reason that they didn't change, And the people who were at the top quartile changed, is the top quartile understood grammar so that when they reviewed poor grammar, they could recognize poor from good. But if you have poor grammar, you can't recognize poor from good grammar, so you don't change your self-assessment, even though you're bad at it.
Yeah, and that would apply probably to the other categories, you know, the logic or the humor as well. You know, if you
it did
and I hope people do appreciate, we realize, for instance, like with humor is very individual. Like Mike and I think we're sometimes funny. Not everyone thinks that.
No, our wives, for example.
That kind of goes without saying. And now we go back to the lover thing, and that's just a kiss of death.
Yeah, nice analogy there. So this is a fascinating little piece. And only by taking them, this was interesting, only by taking those people when they did a logic test on them in the bottom quartile, only by taking that bottom quartile and showing them individually where they had made logic missteps and then showing them corrections for those, did they improve their self-rating. Mm-hmm. But still, they didn't rate themselves as poorly as they really were. So the bottom quartile weren't rated around 12.5. They were rated still around 40 to 50. So it's a fascinating thing that this harkens back a bit to what we were saying earlier. Once you've got an established belief, it's hard to move that belief. But what's more important here is that you if you're incompetent, you're likely unaware of where you're incompetent.
And I'm just going to let the audience figure it out themselves. Guess who you think would have voted for one of the two candidates? I'm not saying one way or the other. I'll let you figure that out.
But what has been quoted from these guys, Dunning and Kruger, is that ignorance more frequently begets confidence than it does knowledge. And that leads to a graph that's often used to depict the Dunning-Kruger effect. And many of you can go look this up. It's, if you look up Dunning-Kruger effect and you Google it, it'll be one of the first pictures you'll find. And it speaks to, as we move from having a zero knowledge of something to being an expert in it, your jump in confidence is so fast right at the beginning. You just need a shred of knowledge to be very, very confident. And yet you're very close to complete ignorance, mm-hmm. but you're at your most confident. And in fact, the expert never returns, the average expert, there'll always be narcissists and all sorts of things, but the average expert never returns to the same level of confidence they had when they had the most limited information.
Yeah. And I wonder, you know, it's kind of, cause I've always thought, you know, then, you know, when you do these things, if you think you're a good singer, record yourself. If you think you're a good guitar player, record yourself, you know, and then listen to it. And you go, my God, it's, you know,
fastidious.
Sometimes it's, you know, I'm not talking about myself, but sometimes it, you know, people who are very good at it are going to be obviously very good at it, but you really can't tell. And, you know, we complain all the time when, you know, you get feedback about, you know, whether you, when you give talks or presentations and, you know, you ignore the one ofs that say, you know, you're either brilliantly good or awful, but you can get, there is value to go in general, what did people think? And, you know, there is, it's hard for you to be, to be able to assess how you did. And, you know, as well as I do, Mike, especially when you're giving a presentation, you could give exactly the same presentation and sometimes it doesn't go well.
Oh yeah, no, sometimes it falls like a brick.
And all I can do is just blame the audience then.
Yeah. You know, there's this guy. Yeah, that's right. That's what we always do. It's somebody else. All blame lies external.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah.
So the one of the quotes that speaks to this is, confidence is ignorance. If you're feeling cocky about something, it's because it's something you really don't know well.
Yeah.
And that's a guy named Colfer.
Yeah.
So it's very true. And there's lots of examples of this. You can look, there's that story of the painting in the church in Spain where a painting of Jesus was getting deteriorated and someone offered to repaint it, but they clearly weren't skilled in restoration and the appearance is awful. But if you look at medicine, one of the great examples of this is around vaccine and autism. And this was a study published in 2018. And they asked people, 1,300 adults, and it was around autism mostly, and they asked them what causes autism. And what's interesting is 36% of those surveyed felt that they knew more about what causes autism than doctors. 34% felt they knew more about what causes autism than scientists who were studying autism.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's fascinating. And then what they did is they graphed their confidence against their actual knowledge scores. And the way they did that, assess knowledge, is they used, and I forget the name of the society, but it's an autism society. And they had a 12-point kind of, what do you know about autism? And what they found was that as people scored lower and lower in what caused autism, they got higher and higher in their confidence, to the point where a number of them, as mentioned, actually believed they knew more about autism than doctors and scientists studying it, when they were in fact the most ignorant.
Yeah, no, it's fascinating that that whole process of what we believe and so on. It's and again, we're not saying that all this information is definitive, but we're just trying to alert you to some of the consequences or the potential of being misinformed, if you will.
Right. And so when you're this is why, and James, you know, in the vaccine hesitancy world, it's often held that the hesitant potential parents or vaccine recipients, those who are hesitant, you can actually have a conversation with and potentially sway. And there's a bunch of techniques for doing that. But those who are fixed, the kind of, you know, the owners of the website, vaccines kill children and all of that kind of stuff, that's impenetrable. You are not going to get through to that.
Yeah.
And their knowledge of vaccines, their knowledge of autism or other things may be very, very poor, but their confidence is exceptionally high.
And
that has to do with something called the Dunning-Kruger effect. And that may help you when you're, you know, in practice and you're trying to have a conversation with a patient. Now, sometimes they will know more. I mean, all of us have been in situations where we've tried to have a conversation with a patient who has is particularly a rare disease, and they come in and they often know more than I do.
Yeah, absolutely.
And sometimes they are really well read around certain things, but many of the times they've just got a snippet of information, like their friend had aches and pains when they took a statin, and that they're confident that they don't want one.
Yeah, no, I agree. Yeah, no, it's you know, and some of this, you know, is, I don't know about you, but as you get older in this whole process, I mean, when I was young, I was confident I knew. Now I'm confident I don't know.
Yeah, that's the thing. If you're confident, if you're confident, as they said, it's probably you're being too cocky because you don't, because it's very hard to know things.
Yeah, but I'm wondering if being confident about not knowing is also a problem. I don't know.
I don't know. But those are kind of three of the key areas that we felt really have kind of flaws in our thinking that we see day to day. Both in our lives, but in our clinical practices as well, that I think are relevant. And it's not just our patients. It's not just the general public. It's not just our colleagues. It's us too. We all make these cognitive errors. I can get very impressed by a story. I probably have lots of things that I think I'm pretty good at when really I'm not very good at. My wife reminds me I wasn't a very good cook, or I'm not a very good cook when I thought I was pretty good. And then some of the other things, like how we kind of get our fixed beliefs and they become almost impenetrable.
So that's this is probably one of our longest podcasts we've ever recorded. So what's the bottom line, Mike?
Well, I just want people to be aware of these kind of three simple, I spent a lot of time reflecting on these and trying to figure some things out myself. I hope that they've been helpful so that people can understand where our thinking errors can occur in medicine. And just to be very cognizant of it, we talked about a lot of examples and how not to be fooled by physiology and mechanisms and stories that way. Just to guard against holding a belief system too strongly and make sure that if you're feeling something when you're reading, that maybe you went in with a predisposition. And then always be cognizant of the fact that where's your confidence coming from? Do you know that this is an area you're really good at? And we don't want to erode confidence in everything we do. That would be an awful way to live. But just recognize that some of that might be misplaced, and it's normal. That's why I asked you about your driving at the beginning, because not all of us can be great drivers. Like, we all can't be above average, but that's where most of us probably rank.
We could all be competent, but we can't. I would really strongly suggest that people listen to many different points of view. I think it's a value to get that. And in your own mind, try to decipher where is this story going? Where is it potentially wrong? Like, you know, what biases are they bringing in? And including listening to this podcast. You know, try that for yourself and just always be skeptical. Not cynical, because that's boring, but be skeptical of all of these things. And certainly be skeptical of you know, the status quo. Because, the status quo is not necessarily the best way to go all the time. So anything else, Mike?
Nope, that's great, James.
Great. Okay, we'll leave it at that. So thanks as always for listening.
Talk to you later.
Thank you.